88.3 Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
Coming up, it's the space show with a different theme than usual. I wonder if you can work out why. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we mark the 50th anniversary of the launch of the final Skylab mission with Skylab 2 astronaut Dr. Joe Kerwin. And here are the ventures with Skylab. So first up, we're going to have Space Show News. Our Skylab was the first United States space station. The space station itself was launched in 1973, May the 14th. On May the 25th, the first three-man crew was launched. After repairing the damaged orbital workshop, they remained aboard until June the 22nd. On July the 28th, the second crew were launched. 1 month into their 54-day mission, Chuck Morley of Cocoa Beach, which is adjacent to the Kennedy Space Center, wrote and sang the song My Skylab Home. It was radioed up to the crew as a wake-up call on 1973, August the 27th.
Skylab, this is Houston through Vanguard. Good morning, gentlemen. This morning we have some music for you to wake up by.
Gazing out the window at the oceans far below, watching them turning seemingly slow. Alarm sounds within, work shift begins. It's time to go outside and start up again. In my Skylab home, in my Skylab home, in my Skylab home, never orbiting peaceful over floating out the airlock on my way to ATM. Replace all the film, then go back inside again. Houston goes by, winking her eye. Here comes old soul, gonna lie. Up the sky of my Skylab home, of my Skylab home, of my Skylab home, ever orbiting peaceful over Earth. Why am I out here? What do we know? Nature's secrets,
to help our Earth grow. And I'll keep on searching from my outpost in the sky. Solving those problems so our planet won't die. Finding a place on the threshold of space. Sailing the skies for the whole human race in my Skylab home. In my Skylab home. In my Skylab home. Every orbit in peaceful over
Good morning. Thought you guys might like to know how popular you are down here.
Who's the writer?
That was written and played by Charles Morley of Cocoa Beach, and I got a tape of it through Bill Cummins of Titusville radio station WRMF.
Oh, very nice. Our best regards to him. I think it's quite pleasant tune, and Jack just said pretty doggone accurate.
Yeah, it sounded like a pretty good tune to me. In case you didn't get the title of that, that was my Skylab home, and we've got about 30 seconds to LOS. We'll see you again in about 1 hour. Exact time coming up is 11:49 over Hawaii.
Skylab 3 returned to Earth on September the 25th of 1973. The third and final Skylab crew was launched 50 years ago tomorrow. Whereas the Skylab 2 and 3 missions had as one of the three crew members someone who had flown to the moon, Skylab 4 was crewed by three novice astronauts. They were Gerard Carr, Edward Gibson, and William Pogue. And we'll hear more about Skylab and the Skylab 4 mission after these messages.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where this is the Space Show, celebrating the 50th anniversary tomorrow of the launch of Skylab 4, the final crewed mission. Apollo 7 astronaut Walter Cunningham directed the Skylab branch of the Flight Crew Directorate during the project development and gave this summary of the Skylab 4 mission.
The third Skylab spacecraft carried an all-rookie crew, the first since Gemini 8. Gerry Carr, Bill Pogue, and Ed Gibson had their hands full. The discipline and logistics of the crew training routine is tremendous in scope. It takes place at sites spread all over the country, sometimes around the world, and calls for a great deal of discretionary judgment by the crew commander. Pete Conrad, as the chief of Skylab, faulted himself for not spending more time after his own mission working with the Skylab 3 crew on training priorities. Whatever the failing, the fellows had their troubles right from the start of their three-month stay. They didn't feel well, suffering a rather well-publicized siege of first-day vomiting, and ran continually behind the flight plan, and then behind the revised flight plan with its reduced workload. Ground controllers and the public became aware of the loaded barf bag in the same fashion as on Apollo 8, the onboard tape recorder. In that earlier case, it was intended. On Skylab 3, it was an unfortunate accident. In all live communications, they had chosen not to mention that Bill Pogue was sick enough to throw up. Their mistake was in discussing what to do with the bag and what not to tell the ground while the onboard tape recorder was taking down every word. The tape was later routinely dumped to a ground site and many hours later replayed at mission control. Flight directors, medical doctors, and management, all the way up to Chris Kraft, were understandably less concerned about the vomiting incident than they were about the subterfuge. The riot act was read to the crew, but the incident compromised both their credibility and their relationship with the ground for the remainder of the 84 days. It was a tough rap for the crew because it was not a self-serving decision, even though it appeared that way to observers. It was a very sensitive issue. No one at NASA told them to be deceptive, but the fact remains that Carr, Pogue, and Gibson believed they were helping the agency in an hour of need. It was even discussed on the same tape that let the cat out of the bag on the vomiting incident. That part of the accidental communication was either suppressed or not considered newsworthy, and it was assumed that the crew was merely protecting a macho image. Carr's crew eventually recovered from their stomach problems, and what had originally been planned as a 56-day mission was stretched to an important 84 days. The endurance mark set by Pete Conrad in four missions was surpassed by Alan Bean in two, then placed out of reach for many years to come by three rookies on their first, last, and only mission.
Now, Walter Cunningham made mention of the motion sickness experienced early in the 84-day Skylab 4 mission. Well, here's a discussion between astronaut Story Musgrave in Mission Control and the astronauts.
Story, I'm not convinced that this is all motion sickness either. I think a lot of the head fullness and all that's got a whole lot to do with it, and I don't think that's motion at all.
I think a lot could be digestive tract all the way down.
I think we're overemphasizing this motion sickness a heck of a lot. I think we got the blinders on. We better look around a little bit more and look for some other ideas, because a guy with the insensitivity to motion that Bill's got to have problems, I think there's something else involved here. People better start looking around a little more and get off this motion sickness kick.
I support that 100%. I think this is not meant to be critical, but I think the experimental design is aiming entirely in the wrong direction. They got horse blinders on, and they got themselves pre-programmed, and they've just closed their mind to some rather obvious avenues of approach. I just disagree with the discipline that's involved in this experiment design.
You're thinking that there may be some other inputs toward sensing motion, such as the cardiovascular system and the like?
I think that I do not know, Story. I don't know that much about it, but I think they have pre-programmed themselves, and all of their previous investigation has been in this one area and has had limited degrees of success, or very good success, I guess, in treating motion sickness. But they got a new arena here, a completely new ball game, and darn it, they're going to have to start open their mind again and start looking again. They cannot adapt their previous investigation to this problem.
I think they probably are trying to look at all those inputs, Bill.
I think the relocation of the fluids in your body. Apparently, there are some people, I would guess, that are a whole lot more sensitive to that than others. And I would be inclined to think that's got a lot to do with this sickness up here.
Yeah, we tend to agree with that also.
One other thing, Story, I think we're already wasting a lot of good crew time here doing this motion sensitivity.
Okay, we got your input on that. Moving on to M171, if you don't have anything more on the M131, now we've got a lot of good data on there. You've probably plotted some of that yourself. All of you are at least up to the pre-flight baseline ranges in terms of efficiency and physical fitness. Ed is starting to improve beyond the physical condition that he had pre-flight. The vital capacity data is excellent. We're seeing a decrease of about 3 to 5% in vital capacity, and some good explanations for that are that you have a little more fluid and blood in the chest. If you had, say, 160 or 200 cc's of blood in the chest, this would not allow you to fill a chest with air. That's a good explanation for the decrease we're seeing.
Logical. Thank you, Story.
In some ways, it is a pity that Joe Kerwin was not in the Skylab 4 crew. Joe was a medical doctor who flew on the first manned Skylab mission. That's Skylab 2. Walter Cunningham profiled Dr. Kerwin.
Joe Kerwin was a Navy flight surgeon as well as a naval aviator. The senior doctor in the group was Joe Kerwin, who had precisely the opposite effect on the troops as Don Holmquist. From the beginning, Joe set out to be accepted as an unhyphenated astronaut. He treated his medical background, as I had the study of physics, as an adjunct, a tool to be exploited within the broad guidelines of a new profession. His medical skills undoubtedly suffered while he concentrated on his new career, but many of us looked upon him as our personal physician more than we did any of the NASA doctors. There were damn few astronauts who didn't hide medical problems from our NASA flight surgeons, but seldom was anyone reluctant to discuss those problems with Joe. Judged by the way doctor-patient confidentiality was respected, the doctors at NASA with the highest professional ethics were those in our own office. Dr. Kerwin was always willing to make a house call for a sick child, even if NASA doctors were available. I'll never forget calling Joe one night when Brian had a fever of 104 degrees, and we couldn't locate the NASA doctor on duty. Joe lived only two blocks away, and he rushed right over. We both got a real laugh when the stethoscope he pulled from his bag was rusty. Joe didn't get much time for doctoring. Joe Kerwin, our Medinaut on Skylab 1, became the first doctor to make a house call in outer space. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, he had nothing to treat. However, he would have come in handy on Skylab 2. That first space station crew suffered some early discomfort, but nothing that really affected their efficiency. The Skylab 2 crew, Al Bean, Owen Garriott, and Jack Lausma, were pretty sick boys for the first few days, and Garriott and Bean had to tread lightly for the first week.
Joe has long been a friend of the Space Show and of the Space Association of Australia, which presents the Space Show for Southern FM. In conversation with the late Peter Iward, Kerwin described his career before astronaut selection.
I started out as a boy and graduated from medical school at Northwestern in Chicago. Took my internship in the D.C. General Hospital, a big charity hospital in Washington, D.C. And I had signed up for a residency in pediatrics. But as my experience went on in D.C., I decided that pediatrics was probably not the direction I wanted to go. So I called up and canceled that residency application. And about 2 weeks later, got a letter from the Navy saying, "Hello there, you've been drafted in the doctor's draft, and you can call such and such a number to get your assignment." I was in Washington, so I didn't call. I hustled over to the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery and found the right desk and said, "What have you got?" And he said, "Well, there's a clinic up in New England somewhere. There's a destroyer squadron. Keep talking," I said. He said, "There's one seat left in the flight surgeon training course down at Pensacola, but you have to sign up for 6 months extra." And I said, "Sold, I'll take it." I did that. I spent my 6 months at Pensacola. My little brother was down there doing flight training as a young Marine. And at the end of that 6 months, they give you about 25 hours of actual flight training. They put you through the primary course. And if you pass the A-12 check and the physical, you get the solo. And I got the solo. So I went back to my Marine squadron, just all dizzy with the excitement of maybe being a naval aviator one of these days. Meanwhile, I did get assigned to the Marines in Cherry Point, North Carolina. There were two new flight surgeons. The other guy was married and I was single. So when one of the squadrons had to go aboard the USS Essex for a 7-month cruise, I was the lucky guy that got to go. The senior medical officer called me in and he asked if that was okay. And I said, "Sure." And he said, "I'm going to give you a case of those little 2-ounce bottles of brandy that we use for special circumstances when a guy's had an accident or a frightening situation or something like that." And he said, "I don't want any of them back." So, okay, off I went with my Marines and we had a wonderful cruise. They let me start and taxi the airplane before we got on board the ship. And You know, I took care of them and they took care of me. They had a plan for all 18 of the pilots in the squadron getting their 100th carrier landing of the cruise on the same day. And they were carefully working the schedule toward us. And the executive officer came in for his annual physical and he had a hernia. Wasn't a big hernia, but it was there. And I said, that's disqualifying, you know. And he told me the story. And I said, well, how soon is the big day? And it was about a couple of weeks away. I said, no problem. I will write a snail mail letter back to the Bureau recommending your disqualification pending surgery. And by the time they get the letter and respond, you will have made your 100th landing. So everybody was happy and came home. And I, after a couple of tries again with the bureaucracy, got assigned to flight training, back to Pensacola for basic, out to Corpus Christi, Beeville, Texas, actually, for advanced training, carrier qualification in the training aircraft. Got my wings in 1962. And now I was assigned to a Navy squadron back on the East Coast. Got some good flight time there. We were sitting around watching the news in 1964, we being my wife Lee and I. And it was the Huntley Brinkley news show. And at the very end of it, Mr. Brinkley said, and NASA has announced that they will hire scientist astronauts to go to the moon. And she looked at me and said, you probably want to do that. Yes, I would. And I got busy and applied through the Navy. And
that was Skylab 2 astronaut Joe Kuhn, who made this additional comment about his career.
Just one last part on this section. What sort of aircraft were you flying there, Joe?
Oh, well, I flew the training aircraft, the advanced training aircraft were the F-9F Cougar and the F-11F Tiger. The F-11F was a pretty exciting airplane. It was a supersonic airplane, but it only had about 45 minutes worth of fuel if you were using afterburner. And that's why it never made a splash in the fleet. But we used it to qualify, and then we carrier qualified in the Cougar. I went to NASA, and they flew T-33s, which was an old straight-wing trainer, and T-38s, which was a supersonic Air Force trainer. We flew T-38s for that time.
Kuhn was selected as an astronaut as a member of a group of scientist astronauts.
Meanwhile, the Navy and the National Academy of Sciences were deciding how to get the group ready for the physicals and the interviews. And there was a misunderstanding. Then NASA told the Academy they were going to hire 15 people. The Academy thought they wanted 15 candidates. They only sent 16 people. So there we were. And if we could pass the physical, and I had inadvertently memorized the 2020 line on the I code. I did so many of them. I still remember it. DEFPOTEC. Check it out. And so got through the physical just fine, waited about 3 months for them to announce who was in. And then in the spring of 1965, I got that phone call and made it into the astronaut program.
That's fantastic. That is fantastic.
It's good luck. It's just a series of things that happened that made a pretty ordinary guy. And I never was really a scientist. I was a physician. And if you had an MD, they thought you were a scientist. But not all MDs are scientists or guys who conduct experiments. You know, a lot of good medical experiments get conducted. MDs are physicians who treat people and learn how to treat them better. And that's what I was good at.
And you're listening to The Space Show.
88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are noting the 50th anniversary of the launch of Skylab 4, but focusing on the experiences of Skylab 2 astronaut Joe Kuhn. Now, we've already noted that astronauts, once no longer strapped tightly into a cramped capsule, often experience what is now called space adaptation sickness. Now, Peter Arwood asked Joe Kuhn about this.
Yeah.
And so none of the three of you actually got any, like, space adaptation sickness or any of that sort of thing?
The only thing for this crew was that along about day 7 or 8, we felt really great. And then we realized that we hadn't felt really great on day 1 or 2. A loss of appetite, a little sluggishness. But again, by the end of the first week, that was over.
One of the experiments dreamed up for Skylab by medical experimenters was a rotating chair.
Oh, and the other big finding that was a relief from these medical experiments came from the rotating chair. We had a rotating chair, and it had a number of experiments performed on it. But the one we loved to hate was where you spun that chair up to an RPM that had been determined by testing of you on the ground. It was a little different for each crew member, say about 8 RPM. And when you were rotating, then you moved your head in and out of each plane like that. And you did it until you didn't feel good, until you had nausea, as a matter of fact, okay? And if you got to the nausea point, sometimes you went on and threw up. So that was one of the experiments in which we, the flight crew, flew to Pensacola, Florida, where a guy named Dr. Ashton Graybeal was the principal investigator. He was a wonderful scientist and a really neat guy. And we explained the problem to him and asked if maybe he could pull the stopping point back from nausea to just malaise. And he said, well, certainly, I understand that. So we did that. And he also excused Pete from doing that experiment on the first flight until we knew more about it. So we'd always have a commander ready to fly home if we got a leak. So he was wonderful. He even let me drive his red roadster around the base while I was at Pensacola.
Fantastic.
And rest in salt, Ashton Graybeal.
Right, fantastic.
The astronauts, pretty much to a man, despised the NASA doctors who, at the slightest heart murmur or aching joint, could ground them. At our Space Association meeting, we wondered whether having an astronaut doctor affected the program.
Obviously, you've got a medical background, Joe. Was that medical background helpful to you in doing those tests and giving feedback to the program?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when the scientist astronauts, including me, that first group of five, descended on the center, nobody really knew what to do with us. But there were two of us in that group that had advantages based on our background. The first one was the geologist who flew on Apollo 17 on the last mission. He was probably the number one scientist astronaut. He did a wonderful job, stepped right in the day we were hired and helped the crew and consulted with the geologists and everything and did a super job. And I stepped into a program in which the big unknowns, a lot of them, were medical. How does the crew really respond for long durations? What's the proper atmosphere? What about the, and even through Apollo and Gemini, the launch vibrations and the abort modes and the G levels and the host of problems were such that a doctor could have an input to them. So I made a pretty good test subject. I learned a lot and was productive and fit in right from the start. The only little difficulty was that I was a doctor in the pilot's office, and the group of real doctors were over there running the doctor part of the program. And there's always been a love-hate relationship between military pilots and their flight surgeons, because their flight surgeons can ground them and wreck up their careers. And I was very well aware of that. and you know, did my best to walk the line of objectivity and not expressing opinions of which I was not entitled yet. Okay.
Sure.
But seeing things through the crew's eyes, and I, you know, they let me be their suit expert for a couple of years, and in many ways I could represent the astronaut point of view, especially in Skylab with all its medical experiments.
Sure.
Had a good time.
Yeah,
Joe, did you and Jack Smith and the other scientists astronauts work together as a team, or were you just really going off to your own particular specialty?
We weren't a separate team. We certainly weren't organized separately. We were just part of the astronaut office, and our duties depended on what Al Shepard wanted us to do. That's why, you know, Jack went off and did his thing in geology. None of the others of us had the credentials to do that, so we did other stuff.
The astronauts had to endure many medical tests, some of them quite invasive. Pete Conrad had first flown in space during the two-man Gemini program, then to the moon on Apollo 12. Now he commanded Kerwin's Skylab 2 mission.
This is a little picture of me drawing Pete's blood. Pete is not looking at his arm. Pete is looking at my head. Pete sat on the ground. He never looked when they were drawing his blood. He didn't like having his blood drawn.
I'm exactly the same.
Yeah. But again, in weightlessness, you're not allowed to pass out, even in the lower body negative pressure machine. There were no other effects whatsoever from having your blood drawn. So once a week, I drew blood and I centrifuged it to separate the cells and the plasma, and then froze it, and we brought it back for analysis.
Astronauts orbiting the Earth are affected by two things that get the interest of medical investigators. Firstly, there is free fall, which allows astronauts to float in apparent zero gravity. Secondly, there is radiation, both solar and cosmic. The question being asked 50 years ago was, how does spaceflight affect red blood cells?
Well, did you notice anything on orbit or after you got back about the blood characteristics while in orbit? Was it identical or very different?
You lose red cells.
Okay.
The concentration of your red blood cells diminishes because they're not being created anymore. The marrow grows silent. And again, one of the really nice things to find out in Skylab, and it took the 56-day mission to first show this, that it diminishes for a while. And when the number of red cells gets low enough that the oxygenation of the blood is beginning to drop just a little bit, the ability to carry blood, that fact wakes your bone marrow up and you start producing cells again, and you remain in equilibrium at a somewhat lower point. So again, check that one off. It's a real effect of spaceflight, but it's not a danger for a long duration.
So does that low red blood cell, I don't know anything about medicine, but does that have an effect, a potential effect on immunity or other types of physiological effects?
No, it's as though you had cut yourself badly and lost a pint of blood. Just that. It doesn't have any long-term implications on all the other things that your blood system does, particularly immune-type stuff.
And that recovered when you came back to Earth?
Sir?
And when you came back to Earth, things recovered then?
Yes, it recovered fairly quickly. Right. This is just another exercise, acrobatics. You can do things that only the great ones can do at the Olympics. In weightlessness, you can do them yourself.
Then there is the question of radiation dose. How does high-speed protons and electrons affect the body?
Obviously, being in Earth orbit, you are somewhat protected from radiation, but I think there was also, there are concerns about being exposed to that radiation. Did you have like a safe area of the station and you had to, that you had to go to in case there was a large radiation burst, the solar flare?
We were for almost always beneath the lower of the two Van Allen belts, which is a proton belt. However, there's an area called the South Atlantic Anomaly where that belt comes closer to the atmosphere. And when our orbit went right through the middle of the South Atlantic Anomaly, we would experience, particularly if we were in the dark, we would experience flashes in our eyes that was evidence that the protons were occasionally hitting an atom and making a light. You know?
Wow.
There were never any ill effects on our vision to be found. It wasn't that bad at all.
Wow.
And the total radiation dose was quite low for all the crews because we were safely beneath that lower belt.
If you've ever looked closely at before and during mission photographs of astronauts, you may have noticed their faces sometimes look puffy in space. This is because the heart, used to pumping blood uphill against gravity, keeps trying to do so. One medical experiment on Skylab was to try and counter this.
Oh, yes. I'm just moving a little bit forward. I just wanted to sort of show life on the station. It looks like you there, I don't know, you're pumping your biceps up. What are you doing?
This is one of the medical experiments. If this was picture had been taken during training in 1G, we would be lying on our back. But this shows the device coming from off the floor of the crew compartment. You slide your lower body into it. You fasten an airtight strap around your waist, and then your buddy sucks the air gradually out of the lower part, and the difference in pressure pulls blood back into your hips and legs that is normally there but has vamoosed into the been redistributed into the body in weightlessness. And the reason for this one was basically after a long period in weightlessness with this redistribution of blood, is the crew member going to be unusually susceptible to gravity again, particularly during reentry when he'll be facing 2 or 3 or 4 G's for a while. So we periodically did this. On the ground, it was a nothing. Up there, it was not a nothing. You'd feel that sensation of lightheadedness. And once or twice, I remember once for me, I started getting lightheaded enough that it was possible that I would faint. A person, especially an ill person, can faint if they stand up and just aren't doing anything. So we had to cut short a couple of them. And that raised some anxiety about reentry on the longer flights. But, you know, it never got any worse. It even got a little better as we got accustomed to it. And that was true right out to 84-day Skylab 4. So it was an interesting experiment, but it turned out not to be crucial.
So just, look, I didn't quite understand that, Joe. So when you were doing this experiment and you had that negative pressure in your lower body, at that stage, sometimes you felt faint or without?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Interesting.
A little bit faint, as though you were, again, standing up for too long, maybe, didn't have enough fluids, and you get a little lightheaded.
Right.
So your blood pressure drops a little bit. Your pulse rate goes up. And PJ monitoring me could see all that taking place.
For the space show, that was Peter Arwood in conversation with Skylab 2 astronaut Dr. Joe Kerwin. And we'll have Dr. Joe Kerwin and Peter back on the show sometime in the future. But this has been the Space Show. It's 50 years ago tomorrow since the launch of Skylab 4, the final of 3 manned Skylab missions, an 84-day mission which set a record. So let's go out with a little bit more of the Ventures and that tune Skylab. I'm Andrew Rennie. This has been The Space Show.